object was to get through a rhythmical something or other without breaking down. No waltz lasts longer than 3 or 4 minutes, and I was careful not to make mine an exception. Then came the compliments and discussions. They thought it was charming, only some of them doubted whether it was quite suitable for a dance on account of its elegiac character, whoa, and so forth. Knew that I was glad enough to get out into the open air, and very glad indeed that it was dark, for the more I thought over what had passed, the more ludicrous it seemed to me, and I laughed till I cried. When everyone wanted him to play a waltz from an indecipherable manuscript, Moritz Hauptmann faked it and had a little joke at the expense of his unwitting audience. By 1829, when he pulled off his hoax, he was working in a rich vein of keyboard humor. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. Many of the great composers had a sense of humor when it came to the keyboard. Scarlatti, Mozart, Haydn, Schubert, and Chopin, for example. Chopin being one who's hardly renowned for humor in his music. What sort of jokes did they play, and do those jokes still work today? Our merry prankster at the keyboard is Trevor Stevenson, rebuilder of keyboard instruments, teacher of piano at Edgewood College, and founder and artistic director of the Madison Bach Musicians. Welcome back to University of the Air.
Thank you, Norman. It's good to be here.
You've been at the harpsichord for us, and now at this instrument, the forte piano, which is not at all what somebody who would think of a piano would expect. The keys, for example, are brown instead of black and white.
Right, and they're reversed, right. the white keys are black and the black keys are white. We don't know why they did that, except that it was a kind of a French thing, and that was a very mannerist way to build them. And so in the 18th century, they liked to do that. You can also see a lot better in the dark playing like this. And maybe they did.
You can spot those sharps and flats.
Right, and so... And that, you know, it's still a portable keyboard instrument. It's only 160 some pounds, which is, as you know, we just pulled it out of the van and brought it up here and set it up. So it's very portable and very. I always think it's an actor. Really, I always think it's 160 pounds. It's a person, but its voice is that of an actor. It has a tremendous visceral quality to it, and very present. And it's extremely articulate. It comes from the 18th century, in which to speak was as important as to sing, in the age of reason and the Enlightenment. And so they did everything in this to make it so that it both spoke and sang. With everything, right, it has leather covered hammers, which make this very. You hit so that, like that. No matter how fast you play, you can hear every note like
it's
that.
A very articulate speaker, yes.
Right. And they also made it so that, you know, the low notes and the high notes are very different from each other. If you listen and you take that down and then it's a completely different.
Almost like from harpsichord to piano in that range.
Exactly, right. So that there is, you know, what Mozart would use, this quality almost has an opera cast under his hands. Like that you got the women on the top and the men on the bottom and all sorts of color differences in between. And I think that adds to the dramatic element that they understood needed to be present in this music. In Mozart's music, and Mozart was my conversion to this instrument, I always knew that Mozart's music was funny. It was supposed to be funny much of the time, and the operas tell you that. But at the modern piano, I could never make it funny. I mean, you could make it delicate. Maybe you could get what we call the Dresden figurine out of it, but I couldn't make it funny. And I heard Mozart play it on the forte piano for the first time when I was about 23 years old, and I laughed. I actually sat and laughed, and not too loud, but I was in the and it's because there's something about this voice that speaks so quickly, and there's so much operatic contrast between the parts, between the men and the women, between the hands, and that was the end of me. That was, you know, I knew I had to go there like that, because I had always worshipped Mozart's sense of humor, and then Haydn followed and kind of opened the door, you know. And we'll start with one of Mozart's very funny pieces. I mean, one of the strangest things that he ever wrote. It's a minuet, believe it or not, that has many changes of key and of direction in it, and kind of a lot of sidling motions. And you can hear his clarinets wandering all over the map here, suggested clarinets at the forte piano.
Endings often can be funny just by being either overdone or, in this case, underdone.
Right. Yep. Boom. Like, yeah, like the little spotlight going out on this. It's been swept away by a broom on the stage. You know, it's just very. I mean, he starts with this thing that's already off balance and a little inebriated. I mean, he's definitely weaving here. And then these three statements come in. He loves to do these dramatic thrusts in threes. He has them all over his dramatic piano works and operas, where he goes, there's one. And then you get it again, a step lower. And like that. And they're almost sphinx-like. I mean, they can't be interpreted. They just stand there like that. And then that comes back in an even stranger form in the middle of the piece, which is...
What? Yes, a tone cluster.
Yeah, it is. Right, right. A smash, right? Yeah. Cherry smash on the keyboard. And then like that, which is just the oddest thing. So anyway, it's a marvelous piece. And then at the end, he does this kind of Duke Ellington here.
Yeah, so Caravan bluesy. A little bluesy.
Yes. So it's a piece that a lot of people would never guess that it was even Mozart. You know, I mean, if you were coming at it cold.
You have one composer here who kind of surprises me.
Uh-huh.
The one description I remember reading of Domenico Scarlatti was of this. It was actually during a harpsichord duel, and there was an English harpsichordist by the name of Thomas Rosengrave who was visiting Italy, and he played just, you know, very well. He thought he was in peak form.
He was it.
And he notices the back of the room, this very serious, dark-haired young man just taking it all in without saying anything, who comes up and totally blows him out of the water, and it's Scarlatti. Right. And we just don't think in those hundreds, I guess, of little sonatas of his as
he was
humor.
A demon at the keyboard.
Yes.
Yeah, he was, right. Nobody played faster and cleaner and with probably more invention than he did, you know. And he really almost invented himself. I mean, you know, his style, I mean, it's derivative from all these other things, but what he came up with is just seems to come from left field.
Yeah, it's not like anything else. And as I say, hundreds of these little 3, 4, 5 minute sonatas.
Right. That, as far as we know, he really got more serious about in midlife, that he started really turning them out. He was probably improvising like this a good deal of his career. But somewhere in his mid-career, while he was teaching the princess at Spain, he started putting these out. And he didn't publish a whole lot of them, but I guess enough of them, right? And they did make their way around Europe, and Bach probably got wind of quite a few of those, too, which is always, I think, interesting. And I put Scarlatti on here not because he's really uproarious like Mozart or Haydn. And he's never uproarious. But I put it on here because the forte piano introduces a kind of an airiness here that I really enjoy a lot. We know Scarlatti played the harpsichord mostly, but he actually did have a lot of forte pianos that he worked with. And there are certain pieces that sound very good of his that sound very good at the forte piano. So I thought we would just try one.
Well, as you say, Trevor, it's a very distinctive style there. I can't think of anybody else who does that. I don't even know what to call it, the sort of trills at the end of a section and at the end of the whole thing.
Yeah, but with such a strange little spin.
Yes.
I don't know. It's like he's done all these weird things. He always comes out standing on his feet like some kind of a amazing dancer or ice skater or something. How he came up with this style. I mean, you can hear some of the elements of it. You can hear Spanish or guitar playing. It's all over the place.
A little touch of flamenco to be.
That's guitar playing. I add those because that's what the Spanish do. And that's very Spanish or, you know, Italian violin playing. I mean, it's that the Italian violin style was always characterized by these big leaps. And he's so bold to just stop the show in the middle and then you go. So that he, you know, rather than, like, Bach integrates the dark and the light often within the same phrase, you know, that they're all woven into one thought. And here, Scarlatti, he just stops. And it is truly remarkable. So I thought we should just do that and see, you know, how this music lives here rather than on the harpsichord. I do have a pedal, which I was sneaking in once in a while. It's a knee lever here. And I can... You hear everything's being smeared together like that. And so when you want things to be mysterious all of a sudden, put the pedal in and it adds a little bit of a kind of a night filter. On the very first forte pianos, they didn't even have a pedal or a knee lever. They had a stop, a hand stop. Like on the harpsichord, you would throw the stop, play with everything ringing together for a while, and then throw the stop back, and then play as dryly or as wet as your fingers could do, but without everything released. And then people fell so in love with this sound that by the late 18th century, you're getting these knee levers and then eventually foot pedals so that, you know, people can put the pedal to the metal as much as they want. You know, it was, I think it's the piano, the forte piano, as it comes in, it's the, I guess Norm Shepherd, who built this, always says that it's the liberator. The pedal is the sign of independence, of allowing everything to ring together, was a metaphor for the age, right, which was, you know, the age of revolution and of democracy. The pedal almost democratizes things.
Everybody talking
things
at once. Uh-huh.
It does, and it allows the whole thing to ring. And it's very interesting. Of course, the harpsichord has no pedal like that. I mean, it's all done with the fingers. And so it's interesting. We're going to study the pedal today, but I thought we should at least mention that it's here.
We are going to hear from a composer who is known for his humor, and that would be Joseph Haydn, right after this. You're listening to University of the Air on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
The friendly, knowledgeable, and helpful people in our Audience Services Center are available to answer your program questions and take your comments. Call them at 1-800-747-7444.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Trevor Stevenson, and with us, in spirit at least, Haydn and other composers who used the keyboard to express their sense of humor. Now, Haydn is one who is known for playing some tricks. We have the Farewell Symphony, of course, where the musicians file out one by one until it's all over, and we have some of his, I think he wrote some comic songs. We have other places where Haydn would play around with the end. Is it over? Is it not over? Kind of thing. What's he do with the keyboard?
Right. At the keyboard, of course, you know, he loved the clavichord, which was the extremely intimate and quiet voiced instrument. It was very articulate. And I think what he does at the clavichord and what he brings to the forte piano as well is a sense of dialogue and conversation. And the word I would use for Haydn is extremely intelligent. And he's very dry. He doesn't tend to laugh at his own jokes that much. He kind of puts it in your lap and then lets you finish it. And he works with these very short motives. We'll hear how the forte piano, I mean, I'll just start this with. That's it. And with a little burp going on in the left hand like that, right? So it's very cagey. You never know quite where he is. And he also, you know, knows exactly how the forte piano will respond to this kind of treatment, with the notes being not only hit with a leather hammer, but cut off with a leather damper. So you just hear like that. So the note is born, lives, and dies in a thousandth of a second. You know? Like that. And 18th century instruments were very good at that. But modern piano, by comparison, is, you know, takes the note almost a half a second to wake up. And that's its beauty in a Chopin nocturne or a Rachmaninoff, is this huge arch to every note like that. So this is again from that age of wit. And you know, Haydn, of course, his strongest medium is the string quartet. And you can hear this same type of writing in the quartets as well.
Yes, he has some witty moments in the quartets, yeah, too.
Maybe the quartets bring out the sense of dialogue and of community more than anything else, you know, and four people locked in a phone booth kind of thing, having to get along. I think you'll hear on the forte piano here how he does that at the keyboard as well, kind of a sense of community and of interaction like that. So this is an early sonata. He wrote this when he's probably around 18 years old. And, you know, he was in love with Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach's music, you know, one of Bach's most talented sons. Haydn said that he took Philipp Emanuel's music, studied it to the nth degree until he had absorbed every element of it, he said. And he said, then my own style was born. And it's a quote by Haydn. Philipp Emanuel, of course, was even much more mannered than this, with irregular phrase lengths and all that. But it had this short speech-like quality that Haydn will then run with. So this is a sonata in G major.
Thank you.
I'm always struck by how much silence is the canvas on which Haydn paints. I mean, you can hear he lives in the country a lot, you know.
Which indeed he did, yes.
It is quiet like that. I mean, in the trio of the minuet. There's just silence behind everything like that. In his music, silence is the canvas upon which he places the notes. And I love how the forte piano makes that rhetoric between sound and silence really come alive. I really, you know, it cuts off quickly and the silences are loaded, you know. So Haydn is wonderful. And in the finale, he's doing kind of a peasant dance thing where it's a stomp dance. Like that, you know.
Yeah, that leads to the old saw about Mozart's minuets being for silk slippers,
right,
and Haydn's for wooden shoes.
Right. Yeah, he is the country boy, never leaves in this music. Like that, it's amazingly energized. Again, the silence, like the little points of light. Haydn is really writing for this tonal world, and his music is probably as idiomatic to the forte piano as Debussy is to the modern piano. You know, it has to be on there for, you know, hear him on his home court, so to speak, you know. So anyway, I was always amazed by how exciting Haydn is at the forte piano.
Schubert writes for it, you're telling me.
Right, Schubert, especially in his shorter piano works and in his songs, right, writes for the forte piano, this five-octave version particularly. Song cycles like the Schönemüllerin and things like this are at their very best on the five-octave piano. And some of the, we're going to do a shorter Schubert piece here. This is one of the musical moments that he wrote a set of. And when he writes his larger piano sonatas, those are written for the six-octave piano. So it's like this. It's still with leather hammers, just a little heavier construction like that. But probably closer to the sound than it is to the modern. So this is the F minor. This is one of my very favorite forte piano pieces. It lights up. Right.
Exactly, yes. It starts out cloudy, and then the sun comes through.
What is that? And I think that opening, you can hear that the leather hammer is his modus operandi. I mean, that's...
That sounds 18th century. That part sounds like one of those, you know, we'll get to it a little later, Turkish marches almost.
Right, exactly. And there's something about the way that... The forte piano and the leather hammer catches what I call like a rhythm guitar here. I mean, and Schubert is so brilliant. I mean, he's like Picasso or something. I mean, he's got an IQ of many millions, you know. And I mean, this intro, there's something about it that literally makes the melody come in. You know, I mean, it almost creates its own melody, you know, in a couple of bars. And he does so in the songs over and over again. The accompaniments almost manufacture or invoke a melody that rides on top of it. And remember, he's writing this stuff at light speed. I mean, he's sitting often in the bar,
yes,
drinking beer, and there's a good chance he wrote this over a beer, you know, and he may not even have played it. And a lot of the stuff he was simply writing too fast to have even played it. So he's probably one of the closest things we've ever had to a medium, I think.
Channeling this music directly from some other source.
And, you know, he died at 31, and the sicker he got, the faster he wrote. You know, so we really don't know quite how he was doing this. And, of course, he's living in the shadow of Beethoven. Beethoven is a publishing composer, you know, at the time, who's doing pretty well.
Publishing big things, and Schubert is songs, always writing lots of big things that don't get bought.
And he's so busy, he doesn't have time to publish, really. I mean, he's just, you know, he's just living one day to the next, living with his brother and all that. He's absolutely flying under the radar. And I think it's all in here. I think it has an amazing quality. And at the end, he with this strange dance going to F major, you know, with these reminders of the minor. Like that.
Yeah.
Listen to that. Should say a little something about the forte piano and dissonance. Listen.
It's a modern chord.
It is, right. These same notes on the modern piano don't sting quite like this. It doesn't have the same, what we call the lemon juice in the cut effect that this has. You know what I mean? And it's because of the thin wires in the forte piano make the pitch very pure. And when you put pitches together that get along, like major chords, you get this great lift because they're so pure together. But when you put pitches together that don't get along, like that, you get an extra sense of dissonance. It's the same notes on the modern piano, but it's got more a kind of a kick to it here, like that.
Which makes the sunny resolution all the sunnier.
Exactly, right. Yeah, it does. It does. Yeah, I know. And it has the kind of, I'll see you tomorrow.
That's right. Come back for another beer.
For two pages of music, it's probably as good as it gets. So anyway, we're so happy he took the time to write it down.
We'll hear from another composer not usually thought of as a writer of keyboard humor, and that's Frédéric Chopin, in just a moment. This is University of the Air.
Wisconsin Public Radio is online at WPR.org. It's a way to stay in touch. You'll find program information, news features, archived programs, and much more. Visit us anytime at WPR.org.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Trevor Stevenson, and we're looking at keyboard humor, especially for the forte piano, and it turns out that this forte piano of his at a svelte 150 pounds brings out all kinds of effects that a more modern piano does not. It's really almost like restoring a painting, and you see these bright colors that you didn't know were under the smoke.
Right, exactly.
Now, Chopin, I realize that he wrote scherzos, and the original term was a joke, but his are not at all funny in my experience, whereas, you know, somebody like Haydn, when he wrote a scherzando, that was much lighter and more entertaining.
Exactly.
So where do we find, you're telling me, humor in Chopin's piano music?
Right. His most whimsical writing is in the mazurkas. The mazurkas are where he really cuts loose, and they're reminiscences of dances that he must have done as a young man back in Poland. Remember, he leaves Poland at the age of 19 or 20 and never goes back. But I think they were the most idiomatic of the Polish dances. And apparently when he played these mazurkas, he felt quite at liberty to improvise. He would add all sorts of doodads, and he played them in a rhythm that was so free, you know, that people looking at the score could hardly make sense of what he was doing, you know, that he would compress beats and things like that.
It had nothing to do with actually dancing at this point.
Right, or it was he was playing on the kind of types of rhythms that the way they did them in Poland when he was young, and maybe even going beyond that into a, you know, into a new type of art. But yeah, exactly. It was beyond dance. It was certainly art dancing at that point. And this is one he wrote in B flat major, Opus 7. He might have written it even before he left Poland. And so this is a very fresh kind of a party piece with you know, I always think as the junior high school dance, you know.
We should all have such dances.
Exactly, with a lot of nervous kids sitting on the sides waiting to be asked.
So what was he doing, dressing up like a gypsy there in those those B sections?
Exactly. It's probably right. The reading I've been doing on Chopin, it comes more and more to light that he was the life of the party. He loved to dance. He told stories. He did impressions that would leave the room in stitches, you know. And so, yeah, was he dressing up? Probably. Or telling some kind of gypsy joke or something. I have no idea. But it's interesting that he was so outgoing,
yes,
at the parties, you know. And yet we can hear what, in most of his music, what a melancholy inner life he had, you know.
Yes, borne out in the biographies.
Right, you know, so it was, I think he fought those demons. But the brilliant thing about that middle section is that he goes away from F and B flat major where he's been and goes off into G flat. Now, all in one pedal. He says, never change the pedal, which you can only do on the forte piano. That is, so I'll play the whole thing in one pedal. And you change there. And then back into the party like that.
It almost sounds like he's going to a cymbalum there, you know,
for
a while.
It is, yeah. It's very much, yeah, like the hammer dulcimer,
yes,
the cymbalum,
yeah,
with a completely... And it's a brilliant piece of writing, because without that section, the whole piece probably wouldn't work. You have to have a ballast somewhere.
Right.
And always reminds me, I don't know why I have to say this, but in James Joyce's The Dead, you know, you're in the party, you're dancing and all that, but the main character, Gabriel, often his mind wanders. He's thinking about the snow outside and things like that, and it's the mind leaving the room for a moment, you know, within the party. So anyway, it's a wonderful piece, and that's a Opus 7 B flat major mazurka by Chopin. And this was written for leather hammered pianos that he had as a young man. The piano still sounded very much like this when he was born in 1810, so it's a nice window onto their world, you know. I think
now I realize that humoresque is a term that implies there is some humor in there, although that application of that term seems to vary quite a bit in terms of the actual content of the piece.
Maybe it just means whimsical here or something, you know.
By the time we get to Antonin Dvorak, though, let's say, what, circa 1875 mm-hmm. or so, are we not past sure. the fortepiano?
Oh,
what instruments is he writing for when he writes a humorous?
Right. I mean, where he's writing for instruments that are, of course, closer to our modern pianos, but with some differences. You know, in the German countries and in the Czech, I believe, as well, the leather hammer actually holds on until about 1850. They make the pianos bigger, heavier wires, but that sound of leather hitting the string, which is what we're hearing here today, is still there, and Dvorak would have been extremely acquainted with it. And it's kind of it has a dialect to it. I mean, you know, I mean, it has a certain, like, you know, an accent.
Oh, for sure,
so,
yeah.
You know, and I think you can hear why the Germans held on to the leather hammer so long. It sounds more German. I mean, yeah, that's than a felt hammer, which is what's on the modern piano. The leather gives it a consonant followed by a vowel. Right, there's actually and on the modern piano, it's not nearly as much of a consonant. It's the vowel is 95% of the sound, you know?
Because, again, it's this arc that builds up to the core sound of the note in the
right.
modern piano, whereas here we're hearing the attack and then something, the softer mm-hmm.
exactly.
coming away.
Yeah, it drops into it drops and sings, right, as opposed to, you know. In the modern piano, the beginning of the sound is largely hidden, and here it's not. I mean, and this is in the key of G flat. We haven't said anything about tuning. We just ought to say a little bit that, you know, in the 18th century, they tuned their pianos and harpsichords so that every key was slightly different, and it was structured so that C major was the most harmonious, and as you added accidentals, the keys picked up a kind of a buzz to them, you know. There's
yes.
C. Sweet. If you go right next door to D flat, which has five flats in it, it's
yes.
it triples the vibrato like that, and that has a huge sense of lift. Listen to it. So when Chopin writes his most melodies that need the most air under the wings, he goes to the deep flats, right? Like that.
Yeah, very airy.
And it has this huge. If you do that in C major. I know, it's country western. Now that's right.
Might be onto something there, Trevor.
And they knew that. They knew it. That there. So Dvorak, when he wants as much air under his wings as possible in this humoresque, goes to the deepest of the flat keys, which is G flat. Right. Anyway, you can hear it. Just it's right. It floats on the air.
whimsical. That's a good word for that form of humoresque.
It is, right. It's an amazing, it's one of those pieces that's so perfect because of the three characters that are talking. You know, the main one, and then you have this aping Brahms here.
Yes.
You know, that the old days in Prague that we had. And then the motto in the middle is that.
Yes.
That's the masterstroke. Again, that's the thing that I think without it, we'd never be playing this piece. And and the Beatles steal it for Yesterday. It's all over. Why did she have to go?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. She didn't say. It's
how about that?
Yeah, the Beatles probably, you know, they listened a lot to things.
Listened and absorbed.
Right. Anyway, it's a wonderful, wonderful piece and Dvorak humoresque, written, I guess, fairly late in his life.
Well, before we walk out the door, what about this Rondo a la Turca of Mozart's that we've mentioned?
Sure. You know, the Turks, of course, had been all over, you know, the Austro-Hungarian Empire before it was the empire, and had gotten, I guess, very close to Vienna and had been driven out in the late 17th century. And they, of course, had left all sorts of their musical traditions. They had integrated with the culture there. We always say, and of course, left their coffee. And so Turkish music was always popping up in one form or another in Mozart's Vienna. And pieces were written in the Turkish style. There were probably all sorts of Turkish musicians that had been left. So this is a piece that is often played. You can add a tambourine and a drum if you want to. You know,
yes.
They even had pianos in the 18th century that had a tambourine and a drum with the foot pedals that you could play while you did this. So, you know, I wish I could hand you one right now.
A tambourine. Where did my tambourine go?
So anyway, this is Mozart's Rondo in the Turkish style. And before we adjourn this session, I just want to thank Norman Shepherd, who built this forte piano. Norman lives in Middleton and has built several instruments, harpsichords, and this beautiful instrument that is modeled after a type of forte piano that Mozart admired greatly, which is a Stein. There's a famous letter from Mozart in which he praises this instrument to his father endlessly, and probably looking for money in one way or another to buy
Mozart.
One. It was his favorite type of instrument to perform on. And I think it's combination of the wit and the dark qualities, the way that the dark and the light are joined in here. He must have been amazing at it. And the Turkish Rondo is a perfect piece to watch how the dark and the light press against each other. He puts them right in the main material. Thank you.
Trevor Stevenson has been our guest this hour. Thanks for returning and sharing some keyboard humor with us, humor for the pianoforte in particular. Wow, what a really enlightening instrument.
From the age of enlightenment. Yeah, exactly. It's been my pleasure to be on here. Thank you, Norm.
I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you'll join Emily Auerbach and me for the next hour of University of the Year.